Hello, my name is Dr. Stephanie Brister. I would like to thank the organizing committee of the annual general meeting for the College of Physicians in Vienna for the opportunity to present this talk in an alternate format than was otherwise planned. I have no actual or potential conflicts of interest in relationship to this program or presentation. I would also like to recognize Dr. Helmut Zinzinger, past president of your society, who extended the initial invitation to me to speak, but unfortunately will never hear this talk. Dr. Eugene Braunwald, renowned cardiologist and author of the Bible for Cardiology. You're probably wondering, what relevance does he have to the issues of gender equity? Well, he was the spouse of Dr. Nina Starr Braunwald. This Dr. Braunwald was the first woman to carry out open heart surgery. She was the first surgeon to successfully implant an artificial mitral valve in a patient. She was the first surgeon to perform pulmonary thromboendarterectomy. She was the first woman to be certified by the American Board of Cardiothoracic Surgery, and she was the first woman to be elected to the American Association for Thoracic Surgery. This Dr. Braunwald was an active teacher of medical students and residents. She was a successful researcher in the area of artificial heart valves and techniques to minimize the thrombogenicity of artificial surfaces. She was an author of 150 scientific articles. She was an associate professor, first at UCSD and then Harvard. This Dr. Braunwald was never appointed as a division head, chair, or chief of a department. This Dr. Braunwald was never promoted to full professor. In 1979, when I graduated from the University of Calgary Medical School, one-third of my classmates were women. At that time, around the world, there was a dramatic increase of women entering medical school. We believed transformational change was upon us. We would train in our fields of choice. Gender equity would be achieved by sheer weight of numbers. By 2017, 53% of first-year American medical students were women. In Austria today, 46% of all physicians are women. Most countries in Europe fall within the 40 to 60% gender balance zone, which is recommended by the WHO. In Canada, 43% of all physicians are female. By the year 2030, the physician pool will be equally split between men and women. However, despite record numbers of women entering medicine, true transformational change in gender equity has eluded us. What is the actual reality today for women in medicine? First, women are disproportionately underrepresented in the surgical subspecialties. In Canada, where 43% of all physicians are women, within surgery, a remarkable 30% are women. This represents a 50% increase from 2010. As represented in green, 30% of Canadian surgical subspecialties have reached the 40 to 60% gender balance zone as recommended by the WHO. Women are well represented in the areas of obstetrics gynecology, gynecology oncology, pediatric surgery, and general surgery. Other countries are not doing quite as well. In the UK, women account for only 11% of consultant surgeons. In US academic institutions, women make up only 21% of the surgical faculty. Austria saw a significant rise in the representation of women in surgical specialties over the period from 2000 to 2010. This is especially clear in the areas of general surgery, where they rose from 11% to 18.5%, and in pediatric surgery, where they rose from 22.5% to almost 32% of surgeons. Unfortunately, I do not have current 2020 data for you. If we focus in more depth in my specialty, cardiac surgery, we find 5% of UK surgeons are women, that's all. Within the US, women represent only 9% of the cardiac surgical faculty, while in Canada, women have comprised 10% of the surgeons for the past 10 years. These numbers are not surprising. We know that fewer women apply for surgical specialties, and women tend to leave surgical training in higher proportions than men. Volumes of literature have been produced identifying barriers to success and causative factors for increased dropout rates in surgery. These include long working hours, fatigue and sleep deprivation, unpredictable lifestyle, impact on relationships, childbirth or child-rearing duties, inaccessibility of leave, poor mental health, bullying, discrimination and microaggressions, sexual harassment and assault, inadequate support, lack of learning opportunities, and insufficient role models, sponsors, or mentors. These challenges manifest in work stress, job dissatisfaction, and burnout for both men and women. But the cumulative effect appears to be greater for women. Another reality: women in medicine and surgery achieve tenure in the rank of full professor less often. In the US, only 21% of full professors, 15% of departmental chairs, and 16% of medical school deans are women. In Canada, the first female dean was appointed in 1999. Currently, there are only two female deans in a total of 17 faculties. In Austria, at the University Hospital, women make up 50% of students, 46% of doctors, and 37% of specialists, but only 19% of full professors. These findings are echoed in Germany, Sweden, and the United Kingdom. Kuhlmann, in her report, found that gender leadership gaps tended to be narrower within the hospital in comparison to academic settings, and this was true through all the four centers examined. In hospital management settings, gender inequality appeared to be strongest at the middle levels of management and leadership. Arguments have been made that women are not promoted because they're not qualified, but the playing field does not appear to be level. Even when equally qualified, women receive weaker reference letters than men. Letters for female applicants tend to be shorter, with less focus on accomplishments, and have more references to personal life than those for men. Gender norms such as intelligent young lady are used more often, as are grindstone adjectives such as hardworking and conscientious. Standout adjectives such as excellent, superb, outstanding, or unique are more likely to be seen in male letters of reference. Differential use of these adjectives tends to imply a woman's success is more associated with effort, while men's success is associated with ability. It is well established in the literature that, on average, women publish less than men and are first authors less often. The impact on career development is substantial. Poor representation on editorial boards has been suggested as one causative factor. Amreen and colleagues analyzed the gender of editors-in-chief and editorial board members of 60 top-ranked medical journals. Only 16% of the editors and 17.5% of the board members were women. Many journals, such as Lancet, JAMA, and Annals of Thoracic Surgery, have recently taken steps to address this inequity. While a commendable action, simply increasing female representation on editorial boards and in positions such as editors-in-chief is unlikely to be a successful strategy on its own. Most determinants that interfere with women publishing lie upstream from the journals themselves. Another reality: women earn less money for equal work. Men cure, women care. It is a restrictive gender norm embedded in our health system on which differential remuneration is based. One is worthy of remuneration, the other less so. In 2017, the World Health Organization reported a wage gap between male and female physicians of 27%. In the US, female anesthetists make 25% less than their male counterparts. Even in a fee-for-service model, Canadian female surgeons earn 24% less per hour of operating than their male counterparts. Women and other minorities do not negotiate well. When they do seek payment for healthcare services, they are often viewed with skepticism and distrust. Evidence suggests that when women are the majority of a physician group or specialty, wages for the position stagnate or even decline. This phenomenon is seen in other professions as well. The pay inequity extends to other areas as well. Research grant money is not equitably distributed. Whitteman and colleagues studied Canadian Institute of Health Research grant funding. Evaluation of a grant was lower when it was known to be submitted by a woman. If grant evaluators were blinded to gender, the evaluation of the grant significantly increased, as did the likelihood of funding. Women experience disproportionate discrimination and/or harassment during training and practice. This is not a problem limited to certain countries or training programs. The true incidence is difficult to determine as it is underreported. In one survey, only 5% of individuals have reported their harassment at the time of occurrence. A systematic review and meta-analysis of literature on harassment in medical students and residents revealed that the most reported forms of harassment were verbal and academic, with a prevalence ranging from 3 to 28%. The most reported forms of discrimination were due to race and gender and ranged in frequency from 4 to 19%. In a survey of 790 CVT surgeons, 81% of female surgeons versus 46% of male surgeons had experienced sexual harassment. Among trainees, 90% of females versus 32% of males experienced sexual harassment. Although harassment occurs more often with women, the incidence is actually shockingly high among men. For women, harassers were primarily colleagues and supervisors, while for men, they were ancillary staff and colleagues. Our medical societies, universities, hospitals, and governments have tried to deal with the issue of gender inequity. Laws and policies, such as those listed below, are ubiquitous. Organizations and institutions have implemented a plethora of strategies with questionable success. A program instituted at Columbia University Irvine Medical Center in 2008 is an excellent example of one of these well-intentioned programs. The university commissioned a task force to examine issues that women faculty face in its medical college. Recommendations were made and new policies were adopted. You will probably recognize many of them. The results of the program at CUIMC are presented here. The deeper blue represents men, the lighter blue represents women. Over the 10-year period of the program, the total faculty increased. As a result of these initiatives, women in the faculty increased from 40% in 2008 to 46% in 2017. The increase of women occurred primarily in non-tenure track positions. The percentage of women in the total faculty who were tenured or in a tenure track position actually decreased from 16% to 12%. While the percentage of men in the total faculty who are tenured or in a tenure track position remains stable at 28%. With respect to leadership at CUIMC, only 11% of 27 departments and 13% of 15 centers were led by women, which was less than the U.S. national average of 18%. The disappointing progress made at CUIMC is not unique. The results are echoed in faculties, hospitals, and organizations throughout North America and Europe. In 2006, the World Economic Forum introduced the Global Gender Gap Index, a framework to capture and track over time the magnitude of gender-based disparities. The index is composed of four categories: educational attainment, health and survival, economic participation and opportunity, and political empowerment. Gender equity in health and education categories has been achieved in many countries, including Canada and Austria. The issues facing women in surgery, indeed in medicine, however, fall into the latter two categories. In the areas of economic participation and opportunity and political empowerment, neither Canada nor Austria are in the top 10 countries. Since 2016, the WEF has published estimates of the time and years that it will take to achieve gender equity in regions around the world. In Western Europe, that estimate, based on current progress, is approximately 54 years. The remainder of the world is woefully behind. For example, North America is not estimated to achieve gender equity for another 151 years. So there may be gender equity in your children's lifetime, but not in mine. Before any true progress to gender equity can be made, a better understanding of the underlying beliefs or myths which inform our practice within medicine and within society is necessary. I acknowledge that much of this work has been done in Europe and North America and may not be generalizable to all cultures. But I think there are still some points that can be made. If we help women be more like successful men, then they too can succeed. Many programs attempt to address gender inequality by fixing the women, by teaching them traditional male skills such as how to lean in, negotiate better, stand up straight, adopt powerful postures, talk more in meetings, and be more assertive. The success of these programs is questionable, in large part because they are based on the idea or bias that the actions of men are more valuable and are the correct way to succeed. However, studies have shown that when women adopt agentic behaviors, they experience backlash for not delivering the warmth and feminine niceness expected of them. In addition, when women make mistakes or fail, they are punished more severely than men. Their failure is more likely to be attributed to lack of skill or ability than unfortunate circumstances. The situation is then exacerbated because other female workers are tarred with the same brush. The perception of other female co-workers is negatively influenced by their female colleagues' failure. Myth number two: underrepresentation of women is a pipeline problem. The Society of Thoracic Surgery Diversity Task Force surveyed their members about their opinions on diversity. Between November 2017 and January 2018, surveys were sent to over 5,000 members. With a response rate of only 9%, the results cannot be considered representative of the entire membership, but they are still illuminating. 18% of the respondents felt the lack of diversity was a pipeline problem. There were simply insufficient numbers of qualified women or minorities to train or hire. Which pipeline are we talking about? The pipeline to medicine, surgery, cardiac surgery, academic leadership positions. In most Western countries, access to medical careers is now balanced between the genders. Access to the main medical pipeline is adequate. Access to the subspecialty or surgical pipelines is problematic. It has been argued that women choose to opt in or out of certain careers because of motherhood, thereby decreasing the number entering the pipeline. But if motherhood fully explained the underrepresentation of women in surgery, then we would not also see the underrepresentation of men of color. The barriers in these pipelines are what force individuals away from or out of certain specialties. The pipeline exists, but the true problems lie elsewhere. Myth 3. Promoting gender equity and diversity contravenes meritocracy. Meritocracy is the belief that through hard work, talent, and experience, one will rise to the top, that jobs, promotions, and money are awarded to the most qualified individuals. In a perfect world, perhaps, but not in this one. In the 1950s, British sociologist Michael Young satirically coined the word meritocracy as a combination of merit and aristocracy. Somewhere along the way, the irony was lost. The concept of meritocracy has taken firm hold in westernized countries such as the United States, United Kingdom, and Canada. It is slightly less rooted, but still dominant in countries such as Austria, Japan, Spain, and Switzerland. In the previously mentioned STS survey, perceived lack of merit as another reason for underrepresentation was a commonly held belief among respondents. There are two arguments that can be made against the use of meritocracy in isolation. Firstly, if individuals do not start from an equivalent social, financial, and educational position, they will not have the same potential to acquire the skills to succeed. It becomes a self-perpetuating system where the rich get richer and the poor just stay poor. The second, far more powerful argument deals with the fairness of the actual measures of meritocracy. In studies that have accounted for other underlying factors, female gender in and of itself is associated with devaluation. For comparable resumes where only the name is different, the man is more likely than the woman to be viewed as hireable. In one startup company, a male narration voice on the promotion video increased the perception of investability more than a female voice. Computers with male names are valued nearly 25% more than computers with female names. In academia, women must be 2 to 5 times more productive than men in order to be considered for postdoctoral positions. By failing to account for innate bias, i.e., that people are not starting from the same place or that the measures are not equivalent, the so-called meritocratic system legitimizes the bypassing of many highly capable individuals. Myth 4. Other people are biased, not me. Bias is not a problem unique to the racists, sexists, and bigots among us. Research on the human brain suggests that all of us, women and men, are biased. It is a coping strategy which enhances our ability to survive. Cognitive biases are shortcuts that allow us to interact efficiently with people, objects, and tasks in our environment. For example, when you encounter a person, your brain rapidly engages in a series of calculations to interpret that person's relevance to you, by placing them within a social category. Age, race, and gender are part of the calculations which form our explicit and our implicit or unconscious biases. Accepting that we have bias runs counter to the view that most physicians have of themselves, that we are fair, thoughtful, and base our decisions on evidence. Difficulties arise when we are unable to apply skills of self-reflection and critical appraisal in order to identify and deal with our biases. There is no better incubator for unintentionally enabling bias than a workplace like medicine and surgery, where demands are high, resources can be low, and the pressure to perform the right action quickly can be overwhelming. These are the environments in which application of stereotypes and other biases are most common. Management research has shown that medical practitioners overlook or misinterpret cues in crisis situations. Explicit bias refers to the conscious beliefs we have about a person or group, which lead to a conscious expression of discriminatory action, such as overt racism, or deliberate activity that denigrates religion, gender, disability, or socioeconomic background. Examples such as the Japanese medical school admission scandal or the comments of Sunni leader Kanthapuram Musliar are becoming less frequent. An element of social desirability may limit the extent to which explicitly biased views are expressed. Unfortunately, they are only the tip of something which is arguably more dangerous. Implicit bias refers to the attitudes or stereotypes that affect our understanding, actions, and decisions in an unconscious manner. These biases, which encompass both favorable and unfavorable assessments, are activated involuntarily and without an individual's awareness or intentional control. Implicit bias testing of healthcare workers and patients shows they have a stronger association of male gender with career and surgery choices in comparison to female gender. Girard and colleagues have studied implicit bias in leadership in an academic setting. They found a slight preference toward men over women among all faculty tested, with stronger levels of implicit bias found in older male faculty. In the previously mentioned STS study, a significant number of individuals felt they had been dealt with in an inappropriate fashion, suggesting that bias did indeed exist. Oddly, most of those same individuals reported that they, however, were comfortable dealing with others in an unbiased fashion. One explanation for STS members' self-reported cultural dexterity, despite evidence to the contrary, may be what's called the Dunning-Kruger effect. The Dunning-Kruger effect describes a cognitive blind spot where individuals with a deficit, in this case cultural dexterity, fail to acknowledge that deficit and overestimate their competence, in this case cultural competence. Most efforts to minimize bias in organizations have focused on controlling or eradicating unconscious bias. Implicit bias training is an example of such efforts. But despite the millions of dollars spent on training people to act without bias, the evidence that it is effective in changing organizational outcomes is scarce. The programs are threatening. They challenge people's core beliefs, sense of autonomy, self-determination, and control. Diversity training, when done alone and not in combination with other organizational interventions, can produce a vast array of unintended consequences. It has been shown to be associated with reduced diversity, worsened behavior towards minority coworkers, and the creation of the illusion of fairness, such that those who claim to have experienced discrimination are actually less likely to be believed. Alternatively, programs that emphasize people's need for autonomy, that increase contact between diverse groups, that encourage personal engagement, and that include all members of the organization rather than only those that are part of the group targeted for intervention, those have been shown to achieve behavioral change more effectively. Examples include mentoring and sponsorship, and diversity task forces. These types of programs circumvent the hesitation to participate because an individual believes he or she is not biased, while meaningfully engaging them in organizational change. Myth 5. Gender equity is a woman's issue. Gender equity is not just an issue for privileged white women in medicine. Gender equity means equal rights and access for everyone. Men, women, trans, LGBTQ, regardless of race or religion. It is a global issue. Many authors attempt to validate the pursuit of gender equity by focusing on the business case for economic productivity, or in medicine, the improved health outcomes. Yes, gender equity policies are associated with better health outcomes and better retention of business and workforce talent. But the discussion on whether and why we should pursue equity should be over. This is a question of social justice. Equity, gender or otherwise, is a basic human right that we should all care about. Myth 6. Men have it easy. No, not necessarily. Men must also deal with restrictive gender norms. In addition, many of the barriers women face, such as long hours, sleep deprivation, maternity, paternity issues, and work-life balance, are challenges for men as well. An EU report found that, despite positive effects of paternity leave on economic, social, and demographic outcomes, uptake of leave remains low because of poor compensation, a shortage of affordable childcare, inflexibility of leave arrangements, and cultural expectations. This may explain the declining interest by men in surgical subspecialties, such as cardiothoracic surgery. Although overall men face fewer barriers to career progression, they too lack systemic support for transforming existing workplace gender structures. Resources such as Men Advocating Real Change, initiated by the nonprofit organization Catalyst, are few and far between. Myth 7. Institutions and organizations can change in isolation from the culture around them. No, they cannot. Gender is a social system which defines men and women as different. Gender norms are the unspoken rules governing the attributes and behaviors that are valued and considered acceptable for men, women, and gender minorities. In our societies, power, resources, and status are distributed based on that difference. Gender systems could be equitable, but they are not. Most cultures grant less legitimacy to gender identities or expressions that do not conform to a strict dichotomy of acceptable behavior for men and women. Most gender systems are deeply patriarchal, ascribing greater value to men or things considered to be masculine than to women or things considered to be feminine. I would like to qualify what patriarchy means in this context. It is not a cultural concept that refers only to men, but instead refers to a dominant cultural form that embraces qualities such as heroism, rationalism, certainty, intellect, aggression. For example, historically, women physicians and surgeons have not aligned themselves with other women workers, patients, or community members. Instead, due to their social isolation, they were more likely to try to integrate themselves into the male social group and adopt patriarchal behavior. Masculinity in women, or femininity in men, or non-conventional gender identities such as transgender, tend to be deeply disfavored by society. Individuals experience powerful pressures to conform. Those who deviate from prevailing gender expectations can experience discrimination and social sanctioning. Transgression of gender norms can be harmful to health, particularly when they trigger negative sanctions. Gender norms have strong effects on outcomes beyond behavior as well. For example, as family medicine has become more feminized, the pay gap between family medicine and other specialties has widened considerably. Change must occur inside and outside of our systems and organizations. It is naive to think that simply increasing representation of women in surgery or medicine is sufficient to transform how gender identities and power differentials are created and perpetuated. We need to move beyond discussions of demographic changes and structural inequalities to cultural issues of gendered ways of thinking. The reality is that when restrictive gender norms and biases exist outside the workplace, in our private lives, they will exist in the workplace. Effective change must be done in concert with change of societal norms. True transformational change will only occur if strategies are focused at multiple levels, inside and outside of medicine. Laws enshrining equity for women have been enacted in most Western countries. These laws should be expanded to encompass the range of identities that represent gender diversity, not just the traditional male and female binary norm. Organizations must lay out specific steps that will be taken to enact their values and goals. They must specify the indicators that will be used to measure success. They need to foster an open, transparent culture with the willingness to experiment and measure outcomes. They need to hold individuals, teams, and the organization itself accountable for change. They have to acknowledge failure and be prepared to change tactics if necessary. They need to identify easy-to-implement, economical ways to change behavior rather than individual attitudes and values. They could try the nudge theory. A nudge makes it more likely that an individual will make a particular choice or behave in a specific way. The environment is altered so that automatic cognitive processes are triggered to favor the desired outcome. In healthcare, nudging has been utilized to improve compliance with hand hygiene. Posters were displayed beside bedside hygiene dispensers, and this resulted in their increased use. Organizations must cultivate positive, gender-inclusive workplaces. They can do so by increasing the representation of women and gender non-binary people in leadership positions, by use of gender-inclusive photos and pronouns in organizational communications, and by adopting anonymous evaluation practices that minimize the potential for bias. Institutions must change institutional norms. Changing perceptions of norms changes behavior. If everyone else in an organization appears to value diversity, we are more likely to act like we value diversity ourselves. With time, these practices become embedded within a social environment. Institutions must have their senior administration and staff walk the talk. The most important source of normative change is a group's leaders. And finally, institutions must implement behavioral guidelines and action plans. Evidence-based medicine has shown that practice guidelines are an effective means of improving quality of care. Behavioral guidelines may prove to be an equally effective means for physicians and other healthcare practitioners to overcome habits and biases. Structured gender-conscious guidelines for academic search committees are an example of these, as are the bias-busting strategy worksheets created by the Engendering Success in STEM Consortium. These tools list clear behaviors and responses that can be initiated when bias is encountered and provide a starting point from which to build specific action plans for a given environmental context and set of goals. It is the responsibility of an organization to create a culture in which people feel personally responsible for change. Faculty and staff should be encouraged to mentor, support, and champion. Individuals also have responsibilities. We must respect everyone. We need to take risks, speak truth. We need to call out discriminatory practices in and out of the workplace. We should demand prompt and non-retaliatory corrective actions in response to gender bias, harassment, or discrimination. We must demand institutions measure all types of work. We must demand institutions have markers to address leadership and pay gaps. We should advocate for family, maternity, and paternity leave. We should advocate for inclusion in hiring and promotion. We should promote the accomplishments of others. We should celebrate, honor, and support all qualified individuals for leadership roles. We need to find allies with influence, and we need to be an ally with influence. We should mentor, sponsor, and help by being available, offering opportunities, and making connections. I would like to acknowledge some of the individuals who have mentored, sponsored, and aided me in my career. Not surprisingly, given my career path, they are primarily, but not all, men. I hope that I'm on someone's list. Gender equity is a multidimensional problem which extends far beyond surgery or medicine, beyond organizations and institutions, and beyond countries. Solutions seem complex, but we are at a unique point in history where ordinary individuals have the potential to affect true change. One only needs to look to Twitter. The Me Too and Time's Up movements are global. Social movements targeting gender roles have gained traction, bringing health policy improvements such as the expansion of reproductive rights in Ireland and the strengthening of the criminal justice system response to rape in India. However, to be truly transformational, this activism must translate to change which is embedded within supportive organizational structures. Women and men must work on two fronts, externally mobilizing support and internally effecting change. It cannot be done alone. Those of us with power, privilege, and social capital must work with those who do not have it. Perhaps, then, our grandchildren will live in a world where they truly have equal opportunity.